This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 6:06 in the evening, and you are with Lynn, Kelvin and Ayman on the evening edition. And we're moving on to our next story, which is about the job scope of an acting minister. And whether said acting minister is limited by the temporary nature of their role. So this is coming after it was announced, to not much surprise, admittedly, that Prime Minister Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad will be serving as the acting education minister.
Yeah, so as we all know, the previous minister, Dr. Mazli Malik, resigned last week. And since then, there has been speculation about who will succeed him. And this afternoon, it was announced that the cabinet has decided that Mahathir will hold the post temporarily until a new minister is appointed. And he had previously been education minister in the 70s, that's around 1974 to 77.
But what would the temporary nature of the post mean in terms of policy making and implementation? Because if an acting minister were to introduce a policy, which in the case of education can be hugely consequential, would that sort of shackle the ability of the next permanent minister to implement their own ideas? It might also oblige the next minister to continue the policy to avoid being seen as making a U-turn.
Yeah, so I think that that's the main question for me here, because like you said, I mean, the phrase U-turn is quite significant for this particular administration. I mean, it's something that they've been accused of doing time and time again. And to be fair, if you were to track certain policies, you can actually see that exact moment where they go, no, sorry, going back to the drawing board. And so I think that's particularly problematic in the case of education, because we've been speaking about this more or less all week. And in so doing, one of the main things that has come through has been this idea of where is the continuity when it comes to education, right? Like, where is, whether it's language of instruction, whether it's specific policies, and what you say or do affects a lot of people, because parents need to prepare, teachers need to prepare, schools need to prepare. Yeah. And with all that said, is the role of the acting minister then to maintain status quo, right? And for how long? And or is it to make these changes, to really behave in every way as the education minister with the possible consequences that you described, Kelvin?
Yeah, and I think my slight beef with it is also the fact that there isn't a clear protocol when things like this happen. You know, for example, if we did have a prime minister that might not, that might be away or had to step down or, you know, anything else, usually the deputy takes over. In this case, it's just interesting that it's the prime minister that has sort of stepped up when we already do actually have a deputy education minister, and that's Theoni Ching. Why isn't she taking up that role? And, you know, I guess I was trying to look for any sort of clear pattern in the past as to how that was taken. So at one point when we didn't have a transport minister because MCA had chosen to step away from that role after very poor results from an election, they decided to withdraw from the cabinet temporarily. And Hishamuddin Hussain had stepped into that role, whereas that transport minister portfolio was traditionally parked for MCA to have a minister right there. So I don't know what the protocol is. I'm not sure if we need them, but you know, perhaps this is just setting one precedent that in case of any empty seats, the Prime Minister takes over.
Yeah, and to your point, Kelvin, I think Praveen agrees with you, because they ask, we already have a Deputy Education Minister. Why isn't she the Acting Minister?
Yeah, which raises that whole question about what the point is of a deputy. I mean, obviously, in day-to-day operations, the role of being a minister is too much, right, for a single person to accommodate. And I think we've spoken before, whenever we have had either a minister or a deputy minister in the studio with us, and they've described the various ways in which they work together, the ways in which some of their responsibilities or tasks are deeply intertwined, or the way that they've split them up.
Or like they're indistinguishable. They basically have the same job.
However, you would think that the term deputy would include this exact moment, right?
Yeah.
Like when there is a void, you step into said void. But I think that the challenge here is really down to the problems of having a coalition. Mm. It's having a coalition and having to negotiate all the different, all the different parties and all the different kinds of associations that the rakyat have with those parties. Because of course, YB Theoni Ching would be from DAP. Mm-hmm. And that right now, I think, has its own
political baggage.
Yeah, for lack of a better term. Yeah. And you would think that being part of one coalition would mean that you wouldn't have to worry about that. But of course, as we've seen time and time again, that is just not the case. So we want to examine this in a little more detail to understand the parameters of being an acting education minister. If you have thoughts, you can send them through. Call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We're now getting some thoughts from Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham Asia Research Institute. Bridget's on the line with us. Thank you so much for joining us. What are your thoughts on, firstly, Tun M assuming the role of the acting minister, especially given the speculations about why he had asked Dr. Mazli Malik to step down in the first place?
I think there are two things here. First of all, he clearly wanted the job from the very beginning. This is something that he's interested in. I think that he doesn't want to turn it over to somebody else at this point. He hasn't found some sort of figure that he could actually turn it over to. So he's basically choosing to take the helm himself. Second of all, I think I don't feel that it was a calculated move on his part to remove Mosley from the perspective of to have himself replace Mosley, but rather to remove the problems that were being caused by Mosley as minister and the escalation of issues. So my sense is that this is really not something that is a conspiracy, as people would. Some people sometimes have a tendency to look at things, but rather he's taking advantage of circumstance.
And what are some of the issues that you think he'll be focusing on?
I think there are two questions here, actually. One is what he needs to do and what he's interested in doing. I mean, he's expressed moving to English in math and sciences. He's expressed trying to introduce some set of reforms in terms of improving standards. He's interested also in dealing with issues of technology. These are things that have been intertwined in his speeches. And I think in some ways he has the stature to do some of the more sensitive changes in terms of the ministry. So this in some ways is an opportunity. What he needs to do, of course, means different things to different people. I think one of the challenges that is very pressing is the issue of Islamization in the schools. And what has happened in terms of the ethnic issues that have become escalated in the last, actually in the last two decades, but in some ways in the over certain issues in the last year, over Jawi in particular. So I think that one of the things that he has his immediate challenge is to de-escalate some of the tensions and to find some sort of solution for some of the different competing interests that are within the education ministry.
So one recent issue is the UEC. The task force looking into the UEC had said that they were unable to submit their report on the recognition of UEC because there was no minister. Would the acting education minister be able to act on this report?
Of course he can. He's also the prime minister. Keep in mind that he has much more powers than a traditional education minister because he's holding two portfolios. And I think, the UEC should be able to give its report, and hopefully there will be some movement on this because there's been movement in different states across Malaysia on this area, particularly in Sabah and Sarawak. And I think that this would be an important step to help to bridge some of the inter-ethnic tensions that have been rising for quite some time.
So let's get down to this, central question then. What is the jurisdiction for an acting minister in terms of what they can or cannot do?
Well, I think, Tun Mahathir is not an ordinary acting minister. He's a prime minister and he's the former prime minister. And so he comes with a different set of stature than an acting minister would do. Traditionally, most roles of acting ministers have limited jurisdiction in terms of the ability to offer sweeping changes because they don't have the sort of credentials of being the more permanent minister. But I think in this case, Tun Mahathir, because he is actually prime minister, has much more powers and the word acting is actually sort of a temper. It may doesn't really have the same status as it would for another person in that particular role.
So I was wondering, and people have also asked why the role of the acting minister didn't go to Teo Ni Ching instead, who is currently the deputy education minister. Why do you think that was the case?
Well, I think most people understand the realities of Malaysia and that the education ministry has traditionally gone to a Malay, and Tio Ne Ching is not a Malay. And so as a consequence to, without escalating ethnic tensions and perceptions, I think that this is a, there were limits in terms of her ability to be able to take over that ministry in the realities of Malaysian politics, given the history of that particular ministry as being so important. And also, I think she would have had a very difficult time from the perspective of the ground in the ministry itself and the responses she would have received from criticism from the opposition and on social media. So in this sense, this allows a compromise, and the fact is that there is multi-ethnic representation in the different positions, which I think allows the focus to be on education reform as opposed to who's holding the post and why and what they mean for different communities.
So what do you think needs to be done to ensure a smooth succession? Do you think there should be a set time frame for the appointment of the next minister?
Well, I think that, you know, one would hope that this becomes an opportunity to engage in meaningful education reform, and given the fact that Tun Mahathir has an opportunity as to kind of correct some of the mistakes that have been made, including in those in his tenure. But at the same time, I think in terms of succession, the ideal circumstances would be to find a minister that actually has his own jurisdiction and credentials. And I think the political tensions and realities within Pakatan Harapan prevented some of that being able to be done. So this is so Tun Mahathir is a stopgap measure. I think that ultimately the education portfolio and the changes of that hopefully will be tied to some sort of cabinet reshuffle that will help to bring a sense of more confidence in Pakatan Harapan's governance.
Bridget, thank you so much for speaking with us. That was Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham Asia Research Institute. And it didn't... I'm just now suddenly struck by the fact that this question of succession for Tun Mahathir is going to be on two fronts. It's I mean, what is this world that we live in? Which kind of brings me also to this message that came from Faizal Azlan.
What if Tun M becomes acting minister, then full education minister once the PM swap happens?
This is the reality in which we live. It's quite frightening. Faizal also goes on to say, can I dare to be blunt by saying that in the situation involving the deputy minister, it's because of race and a pre-agreed seat which would belong to Bersatu?
Which is a point that Bridget did bring up, right? That the seat has traditionally gone to a Malay candidate. And I think, you know, I guess the silver lining that Tun M, to me, is like Tun M is also probably the safest choice here. Had he appointed someone else, then the next question would be, okay, why is this person then only staying in this seat temporarily? Why not just give this person the full seat until the term ends?
General Jason says on WhatsApp, one of the glaring issues with PH is that the smallest party has the biggest say.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges of being part of a coalition, mm-hmm. and also an important a party that is seen as having brought a certain amount of clout, mm-hmm. right? Having brought a certain amount of votes into the GE. And because of that, and I suppose because of all the other things that we've already talked about, that's where that's coming from. Now, whether or not that's going to last, whether or not there's going to be ever a reconfiguration of that, I don't know. But at this point in time, I think those are the fundamental reasons why it is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, the education ministry has been the center of heated discussions throughout Dr. Mazli's time. And I think having Tun Mahathir in the seat right now is a move to sort of stabilize things, to steady the boat a bit. Because, you know, he being an influential figure who happens to be from Pakatan Harapan as well, who happens to be Malay as well, he would be the one seen by the cabinet as, you know, the person to perhaps smoothen things up when the right time comes to give it to the next person, whenever that is.
Which is the point that Adeline's making, saying Tun M unfortunately is the only one who has enough clout to make progressive changes in the education system. Mm-hmm. It's just sad that he wasn't able to groom someone to take on the role as PM or education minister. And that, I think, so a couple of interesting points there. The idea of having enough clout to make progressive change, I think that is something that's been brought up over and over again, which is that if you really want to see any sort of meaningful change in our education system, it's going to have to come with political will, and it's going to have to come with the strength, you know, to kind of push those things through. Because whatever you do in education, you're going to get shouted at. So you have to be someone that people can't shout at.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a recent poll by Merdeka Center also showed that Tun Mahathir is still seen as someone who is watching and observing over Malay rights. So if we were to include conversations about race and education together, you know, he is still a very good candidate for the post of education minister.
That point also about grooming a second layer of leadership is important, because that is an ongoing conversation that we have been having about actually on both sides, right, of the divide. I don't mean to just say that it's a Pakatan Harapan problem. I think that it is a political thing where there seems to be this distance between sort of very young up-and-comers and then people who are literally 90. and so that middle bracket, I think, what I suppose in another sense of the term would be middle management, I think that hasn't necessarily seen the kind of... we haven't seen the kind of vision or the kind of communication that you would want in order to know that, yeah, this is clearly the next layer of ministers, the next cabinet. We don't see that coming through very strongly, I think.
I think there's a bit of a cultural thing there as well, because, you know, if all the top posts are held by the more experienced, the one who have been in politics for decades and decades, then, you know, there is a sense that, you know, let the elders hold the important positions first. You can wait for your time when it comes. But what that means is that in terms of grooming and giving the younger, the next batch of politicians and leaders coming in, grooming them, training them, that will be slowed down because of the important posts being held by those who have been here for a long time.
KW says, sounds like permanent acting minister, which, I mean, I'm hoping, again, going back to that point about succession, I'm hoping that the reluctance to actually set a date is not going to extend in every which direction. Because I think in the way that this question of who's going to be the prime minister has really overtaken in some ways our national political narrative, we don't need a 2.0, right, in the form of who's going to be the next education minister. Although, having said that, you want the right person. And getting the right person might take time. So I think we're caught in this exact balance. So we are going to be continuing this conversation after this. You can send us your thoughts. Call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back after the 6:30 news. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.